Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. With Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks watching, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act on August 6, 1965. President Johnson said the vote was the most powerful instrument ever devised by man for breaking down injustice. Before the act was signed, poll taxes, proof of residency, and very complicated literacy tests were used to keep African Americans from the ballot box. But the Voting Rights Act had an immediate effect. According to the Brennan Center, the gap between white and black registration rates dropped from nearly 30 percentage points in the early 60s to just 8 by the 70s. Turnout among black voters shot up significantly. The black-white turnout gap in the South, which was about 50 percentage points in the mid-1950s, was effectively eliminated. The Voting Rights Act was then expanded in 1970 and 1975 to include Latinos and Native Americans. John Roberts, now Chief Justice Roberts, unsuccessfully fought the expansions as a lawyer in President Reagan's Justice Department during the 1980s. And then we got the 2000 election. 12,000 people were wrongly labeled as felons in Florida when Jeb Bush was governor and were not able to vote. Since then, we have seen a wave of successful efforts to disenfranchise voters. The right to vote is being threatened across the country, and it's very difficult to challenge new restrictions. From 2011 to 2015, 468 voting restrictions have been introduced in 49 states. 15 states will have new voting restrictions in place for next year's presidential election. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about the current state of the Voting Rights Act, what can be done to fight the onslaught of voting restrictions, and how will these restrictions affect next year's election. Today we're joined by Jerry Hebert, Executive Director and Director of Litigation at the Campaign Legal Center. For two decades, Jerry served in the Department of Justice's voting section of the Civil Rights Division. He's also served as Chief Trial Counsel in over 100 voting rights lawsuits, a number of which were decided by the Supreme Court. And Jerry Hebert joins us from Washington. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. Thank you very much for having me, and I'm looking forward to participating.
Well, thank you for joining us. Thomas Lopez is counsel for the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, where his work focuses on voting rights and elections. Thomas is past fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Immigrant Justice Project. When he was there, he worked on litigation and advocacy challenging anti-immigrant legislation in Alabama. And Thomas Lopez joins us on the line from New York. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really glad to have both of you on the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. And Jerry, since you have been a counsel in over 100 voting rights lawsuits, I just wonder, this is must be such an important day for you. How are you reflecting today?
Well, I first of all started the day by tweeting a happy birthday, 50th golden anniversary birthday to the Voting Rights Act. I followed that up by going to the Department of Justice, where I was with Attorney General Lynch and leaders of the Civil Rights Division, where we were commemorating the successes of the Voting Rights Act. And I just returned from the Justice Department to be on a call with you. So it's been a very good day, and it's continuing by being allowed to talk about the most important piece of civil rights legislation that Congress has ever enacted, the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
And Tomas, what about you? How are you reflecting this afternoon?
Well, I think, you know, number one, by joining you all and by joining someone like Jerry, who's got this fantastic track record of defending voting rights. And, you know, it's worth noting that right now here in New York, many of my colleagues are at a large rally that we're holding on Foley Square, trying to, again, raise awareness of this issue, to remind the general public that not only has the Voting Rights Act been around for 50 years, not only is it still around, but that we need Congress to make sure that we have it going forward.
Right. And we will talk about that. But let's go back in time to when the Voting Act's rights was signed. And when you look at the instant effect it had, It's kind of amazing, not surprising, but it is amazing when you look at the numbers. So the gap between white and black registration rates dropped from about 30 percentage points in the early 60s to just 8 by the 70s. And then turnout among blacks shot up significantly. The black-white gap in the South was about 50 percentage points in the 50s. And then after the Voting Rights Act was signed, it was effectively eliminated. Jerry, can you talk about that, just the power of the Voting Rights Act and the changes we saw so quickly?
I sure can. I spent many years in Selma, Alabama, which is the birthplace, really, of the Voting Rights Act. And one of the things that was always amazing when I looked back in Selma and saw the instant progress the Voting Rights Act brought to Selma and so many other places like it was that in 1965, when the Voting Rights Act got passed, even though the county that Selma is in was about 50% African American, only 1% of the African Americans who lived in Dallas County, which is where Selma is, were registered to vote. A year later, 9,000 African Americans from Dallas County were registered. What the Voting Rights Act did instantly is it put in federal voting registrars in many Deep South locations to actually register voters so that voters, minority voters, African Americans, and some other minority voters who wanted to register wouldn't face hostile, intimidating, and harassing white registration officials and could instead go to a more receptive federal registrar where they could then register to vote and participate in elections. And so instantly the whole franchise was granted to literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people immediately following the 65 Act. And, of course, that let them not only vote but start to elect candidates to office. And that changed the racial makeup of southern legislatures in particular, city councils, school boards, and county commissions. So the act had immediate and positive impact.
And we often focus on blacks when we talk about the Voting Rights Act, but can you also talk about what it did for Native Americans?
Well, the Voting Rights Act protects all minority voters, and Native Americans are no exception. They, in particular, oftentimes suffer from the same kind of intentional discrimination that was aimed historically at African Americans. In many cases that I've been involved in where Native Americans have been victims of voting discrimination, it's often due to the language barrier that many Native Americans face or the fact that they live in such disparate areas that they have to travel so far just to cast a ballot, oftentimes, over 100 miles, 200 miles in some cases, round trip. And so getting polling places on the reservation, translating the ballot into languages that Native Americans have their native tongue. Those are very important, and we've been very successful in those cases on behalf of Native Americans. I personally was involved in cases on behalf of Native Americans in Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona, where, again, federal courts ordered the states to come up with bilingual election officials who could explain the ballot to Native American voters in languages that they could understand.
And what about Latinos, Tomas? How did the Voting Rights Act affect Latino voters?
One of the things that's really important to know about the Voting Rights Act is that there are provisions that protect language access. And certainly when you look at Latino populations, I'm in New York City. The five boroughs of New York City were covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. A number of counties in California were covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And this was a law that was able to ensure access to the vote for people who, again, Jerry just spoke about, people who had language barriers. In many cases, a lot of Latinos were dealing with just that, and the Voting Rights Act was able to deliver the ballot to those people.
And let's talk about one very important section of the Voting Rights Act. Section 5 was particularly instrumental in achieving these successes. Again, your colleague at the Brennan Center has a great piece about this, writing that under this part of the law, jurisdictions with a history of discriminating against African Americans were required to seek approval or preclearance from either the DOJ or a federal court for any changes to their election practices before they could put them into effect. So, Jerry, tell us why Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was so critical.
Well, it was critical for several reasons. First, it put the burdens of time and inertia and expense on the shoulders of the perpetrators of discrimination rather than on the victims. In other words, state and local governments with a long history of discriminating against voters on account of their race, color, or language minority status had the burden of proving that their voting changes were non-discriminatory before they could go into effect, as you noted, Rose. And that was so important. It was like having an instant injunction to prevent a voting change that was discriminatory from going into effect. And the burden of proof was on the state or local government to prove non-discrimination of their voting change, since we were impacting a fundamental right like the right to vote. Going to also the Department of Justice or a federal court in Washington, D.C., gave a uniformity to the process. You had the Justice Department was considered to be the leading enforcer of the Voting Rights Act. They had issued regulations so jurisdictions could understand what their duties and responsibilities were. But to actually have voting changes frozen in time and reviewed to ensure their non-discriminatory aspects before they went into effect was huge. And that was what was, of course, taken away by the Shelby County decision just a couple of years ago by the Supreme Court.
Right. And I'm guessing that a lot of people really weren't that familiar with Section 5 until the Supreme Court decision. And again, it's just so important to repeat this. Before the Voting Rights Act was signed, when a discriminatory voting practice was blocked through the courts, defendants could turn around and adopt a slightly different restriction in its place, and that was okay. And that's why Section 5 was added to the Voting Rights Act. It aimed to really end this altogether, and it did. Tomas, again, what would you add to that? Why is Section 5 so important?
Well, I think another thing that folks should understand is that there are thousands upon thousands of jurisdictions in this country that run elections. There are states, there are counties, there are large cities, small municipalities. And one of the things that Section 5 allowed was for all of us to actually see all the changes that were happening and for those to be in a central place and for us to know, okay, here is something that is happening. We know that, you know, Section 5 didn't always block, but Section 5 always let us know what was happening.
And so let's talk about what happened in 2013, because this was a major, major decision by the Supreme Court. Jerry, first off, can you give us just a little bit of background of a Shelby versus Holder?
Yes. What Shelby v. Holder was about was a challenge to the constitutionality of a provision of the Voting Rights Act that described a formula for deciding which jurisdictions, state and local governments, would have to undergo this pre-approval or pre-clearance process that we just discussed. And about 16 or 17 states were subject to these provisions of pre-clearance and had been operating under them for many years. Their constitutionality had been challenged on several occasions prior to 2013, and the Supreme Court had upheld the provisions of the Voting Rights Act that were under challenge in the Shelby County case on several occasions, saying that they were a rational way for Congress to deal with ongoing voting discrimination. And the challenge that was brought to the preclearance formula basically said that times have changed, that discrimination is a thing of the past, and that for the most part, and so we don't really need to have these jurisdictions with a long history of discrimination to have to undergo this pre-approval process anymore. And so they filed a lawsuit in federal court in Washington. It worked its way up to the Supreme Court. And just in fact, if I could just add one more thing, 2 years prior to 3 years prior to Shelby County, an identical case had been brought out of a jurisdiction in Texas, and the Supreme Court had said, look, we're not going to declare the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional. In fact, there's a provision that allows state and local governments who've been non-discriminatory for 10 years to bail out and not be subject to this act anymore if they can simply show that their voting procedures are non-discriminatory. And in those couple of years before Shelby County, when the Supreme Court had addressed this issue, hundreds of jurisdictions had decided, well, it's a good badge of honor for us to actually go and bail out and show that we are non-discriminatory. It's a thing we should be proud of. It was an incentive to end discrimination, and a lot of jurisdictions, state and local governments, and I represented many of them, went ahead and got bailed out because they were non-discriminatory. And the Supreme Court, when it decided Shelby County, didn't even reference this fact that there was an escape hatch for jurisdictions.
And this really came full circle for now Chief Justice John Roberts, because he unsuccessfully fought expansions of the VRA, even though, I want to get my timing right, in 1982, President Reagan signed a 25-year extension of the Voting Rights Act. But Chief Justice John Roberts, who was a lawyer in the Justice Department under President Reagan in the 1980s, he drafted a number of op-eds and memos for top DOJ officials that argued for a weaker version of the law. What do you remember about John Roberts back then, Jerry?
Well, I remember him fighting vigorously to avoid amending the Voting Rights Act in a way that would improve the opportunities for minority voters. And I'll give you the example. In 1982, as you correctly pointed out, Congress was faced with an extension of the Voting Rights Act. It had been reenacted in 1975 for a seven-year period. And in 1980, just 2 years prior to the extension, the Supreme Court had dealt a very bad blow to Voting Rights Act in a case out of Mobile, Alabama. And Congress, in deciding to not only extend the act, decided to try to enact legislation that would prohibit jurisdictions throughout the United States from adopting voting practices and procedures that resulted or had the effect of discriminating on account of race, color, or membership in a language minority group. And John Roberts fought against that, basically saying, no, we ought to make those who are trying to challenge these laws prove discriminatory intent or purpose, which is a very high bar to get over. Even as of 1982, you didn't have a lot of jurisdictions, officials using the N-word or admitting that they were engaging in discrimination intentionally. And so to have kept the bar high, which John Roberts was as a lawyer in DOJ, and I was a lawyer in DOJ at the time arguing against this, trying to get the intent standard be the law in the Voting Rights Act instead of an effects or results test, it was a big difference, and it would have actually set back and delayed equal opportunity for minority voters. Fortunately, higher officials, including Senator Dole in the Senate, for example, worked out a compromise where there was a results test adopted in 1982, and President Reagan then signed that bill, and it's been the law ever since. Mm.
What was it like for you, Jerry, when the Supreme Court in 2013 came down with its decision to strike down part of the Voting Rights Act, specifically Section 5?
Well, I was in the courtroom that day. It's a day I will never forget. It's kind of like a day when you first find out you passed the bar. You kind of remember where you were when you heard the news. It was like a dagger that went into my heart, because the Voting Rights Act, I've been a lawyer for 42 years. I've devoted nearly all that time to protecting the right to vote and enforcing the Voting Rights Act, both as a Justice Department official and as a private attorney, and now here at the Campaign Legal Center. And to take away the most powerful weapon that Congress has ever enacted, the preclearance provisions that were struck down in Shelby County, was devastating. But like most of the people who've been involved in civil rights, Rose, we instantly decided that we were going to do something about it. We weren't just going to lick our wounds and go quietly. We instead, and I'll give you one example, one of the laws that had been blocked by the preclearance provisions was Texas's adoption of a photo ID law. Mm. And as soon as the Supreme Court decided Shelby County, the then Attorney General of Texas, Greg Abbott, now the governor there, tweeted an hour later that the photo ID law is now in effect because the preclearance provisions have been taken off the table. And we got with our clients and we said, you know what, we're going to go to court. And we went to court over that, and we sued over it, and we won. Just yesterday, in fact, a decision from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit that found that the Texas photo ID law was indeed discriminatory under the Voting Rights Act, a huge historic victory. But again, I don't want to overlook the fact that this took a couple of years to get this result, and it was an enormous expenditure of time and resources that previously you didn't have to do because Section 5 preclearance, again, stopped things in their tracks, like the Texas photo ID laws and hundreds of other laws that were enacted.
Jerry Hebert is Executive Director and Director of Litigation at the Campaign Legal Center. For two decades, he served in the Department of Justice's Voting Section of the Civil Rights Division. He served as Chief Trial Counsel in over 100 voting rights lawsuits, a number of which were decided by the Supreme Court. Tomas Lopez is counsel for the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, where he focuses on voting rights and elections. He's past fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Immigrant Justice Project. Today, we are marking the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act by talking about its significance, where we are today. 15 states will have new voting restrictions in place for next year's presidential election. So what questions do you have about the Voting Rights Act? If you remember when the VRA was signed, what do you remember about the changes that happened immediately after it was signed? And what are your thoughts about where we are today? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Tomas, before we get to calls, it was kind of amazing to see that hours after Section 5 was struck down, as Jerry said, Texas implemented a strict photo ID law just hours after that happened. And then that summer, the North Carolina legislature passed a law that instituted a photo ID requirement. Were you surprised to see these things happen so quickly after Section 5 was struck down?
Well, you know, it's worth noting that both Texas and much of North Carolina were states that were formally covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. You know, we suspected that we might see things like this happen, and unfortunately they did. You know, I think one of the things that was really striking about those voting law changes was that they happened so quickly. Then Attorney General Abbott tweeted that right away. In North Carolina, there was a state representative who said after the Shelby County decision, now we can go with the full bill. And that full bill in North Carolina included not only a photo ID requirement, but a whole range of voting restrictions that really took away things that were really popular with North Carolina voters, reductions to early voting, the elimination of same-day registration, the elimination of pre-registration, which is the ability to register to vote before you're 18 years old. And so when we talk about these voting restrictions looking forward, we speak not only of the ID laws that we see as so problematic, but a whole range of issues.
And a whole range of issues, yes, because from 2011 to 2015, 468 restrictions have been introduced in 49 states. And Jerry, Ari Berman is out with a new book about voting, and he says that it's incredibly difficult to challenge these laws. Is that because of the Supreme Court decision in 2013?
Well, yes, because now instead of having the preclearance provisions block them until state and local governments can show that they're non-discriminatory, and they have to do that, and the DOJ or the federal court in D.C., you know, had a clock that they had to make a decision under so the states weren't unduly burdened by it. But now those laws went into effect, and the only way you can stop them is going into court, which is an enormous burden. Their cases can be very complicated. And they're very time-consuming, and they cost a lot of money. In the Texas photo ID case, I'll bet that the bill for the plaintiffs is probably $3 million in order to bring that lawsuit.
Wow. And so where's that money coming from? People who care about these issues, funders, and then just average citizens?
Yes. Happily, average citizens have come forward and made donations through, you know, the Legal Center. Funders have stepped up to fight these challenges. And so from a number of different sources, we still never raise enough money to really bring the case. Just the out-of-pocket expenses alone, Rose, probably cost close to $1 million just that.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about voting rights 50 years after the law was signed. We'll be back after this. Mm-hmm.
Lots of ways to join in today's conversation on Your Call, on the phone, or by sending an email. The address for email is feedback@yourcallradio.org, feedback@yourcallradio.org. The toll-free phone number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11 o'clock here on Local Public Radio, World Have Your Say from the BBC. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of the treatment of undocumented immigrants in detention centers. We will also talk about a BuzzFeed investigation about U.S. employers exploiting documented H-2 guest workers. And we'll talk about the tragic killing of the renowned Mexican photojournalist Ruben Espinosa. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the status of the right to vote 50 years after President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, which went into effect immediately, and we saw major changes right away. Unfortunately, there is a major, major attack on the right to vote. From 2011 to 2015, 468 voting restrictions have been introduced, and we'll talk about those restrictions. Voter ID laws get the most attention, but what else is going on in terms of restrictions? 15 states will have new restrictions in place for next year's presidential election. Tonight is the first Republican debate, and considering it is the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, we'll be watching to see if they're asked any of these questions, because Jeb Bush, of course, was the governor of Florida during the 2000 election, and then Ted Cruz was a 29-year-old lawyer who put the law team together when they were fighting the recount, and we'll talk about that on today's show. So I hope that they ask questions, but we'll have to see if that happens. Today we're joined by Jerry Hebert, executive director and director of litigation at the Campaign Legal Center. Jerry served as chief trial counsel in over 100 voting rights lawsuits, a number of which were ultimately decided by the Supreme Court. Tomas Lopez is counsel for the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, where his work focuses on voting rights and elections. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann.
Yes,
welcome to the show.
Bring into the mix access for people with disabilities at polling sites. I know I've run into a lot of that, and sites on my ballot that said they were accessible weren't, and that largely I wanted to ask either the guests if they knew anything about after the debacle in 2000 with the Bush Gore voting machine nonsense. The legislature came up with the Help America Vote Act, and since that was purporting to make voting easier with electronic machines and all that, it opened up a whole other can of worms for folks who really didn't trust electronic voting and machines.
Right.
Even if they were supposedly going to be more accessible for people who had disabilities, and if blind people would have access. I know I went and tried out one of those machines. I am not blind. I use a wheelchair, but I asked them if I could try the gizmos for, you know, being blind, because I was checking out the sites. And I just didn't know if either of the guests had any knowledge of what transpired prior to the Help America Vote Act and following it.
Okay, thank you. Tomas, do you want to take that one first?
Sure, I'd be glad to. You know, I think the caller explained really well that the Help America Vote Act, the law that was passed after the 2000 election, that provided for the creation of an agency called the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. And I lead with that because I think that's really important for folks to understand that there's a federal agency that exists to assist states to actually help administer elections, to make sure that elections are accessible, and in particular, to make sure that our voting machines are working the way they're supposed to. We at the Brennan Center are actually going to be releasing a report soon that talks about the state of our voting machines, and the state of those machines is not very good. There's about a 2 years ago, there was a Presidential Commission on Election Administration that involved the campaign lawyers for both President Obama and Governor Romney. And among their many conclusions was that the country was on the verge of a voting machines crisis. And we were seeing that that's in fact the case. Many of the machines that were purchased following the passage of HAVA are now close to being obsolete. And we are seeing that in places all over the country that machines are not as reliable as they need to be, they're not as usable as they need to be, and that could be problematic in the upcoming election cycle.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting because when President Obama won the election, I found that a lot of people who worked on this issue, they weren't really as loud as they were under George W. Bush. What are your thoughts on the electronic voting machines, Jerry, and what concerns you about them?
Well, first of all, I've often felt that the Help Americans Vote Act should be amended in its title to be Help Americans Vote Act Not So Much, because we still find that people with disabilities and are denied access to the voting process. There was a law passed back by Congress, which is still in effect, back in 1984, called the Voting Accessibility for the Elderly and Handicapped Act. And that requires states to take certain steps to make the voting process accessible to people with disabilities. And I think it's a very underutilized provision. I would like to see the Justice Department in Washington bring more cases on behalf of people with disabilities, including voting machines, which, as Tomas has correctly pointed out, are still remain very problematic, not only for people with disabilities, but also others.
Right.
And there's also a provision, Rose, of the Voting Rights Act that provides that voters who need assistance to vote by reason of their disability or their inability to read or write are entitled to have an assister of their choice with them. So I encourage voters to undertake their rights under that provision. It's Section 208 of the Voting Rights Act.
Well, thank you for calling in, Ruthann. And I'm going to propose a show about electronic voting machines because we can spend an entire hour on that. Jane emailed saying she's concerned about these, and she recommends a book called Code Red, Computerized Election Theft and the New American Century by Jonathan Simon. So thank you for that, Jane. And I'd like to talk now about the 2000 election because a lot of things happened during the 2000 election, and since then, we have seen major efforts to disenfranchise voters. And I mentioned Ari Berman. He's out with a new book called Give Us the Ballot. And he basically argues that the year 2000 played a very seminal role in disenfranchising voters. And we saw a major felon voter purge. 12,000 people were wrongly labeled as felons in Florida and were not able to vote. That's 22 times Bush's 537 vote margin of victory, right? He won by 537 votes. And first off, Jerry, when we have a voter purge, who makes these decisions? That's one thing I'm still not clear of. So 12,000 people on this list, who put these people on that list?
Well, what happens is that the secretaries of state in the states have responsibility in nearly every state for maintaining a statewide voter registration database. And groups come along, and in the case of Florida that you're talking about, a group that was very pro-Republican, frankly, with partisan intent, had a contract with the state of Florida, and the U.S. Civil Rights Commission actually did an investigation of this in the early 2000s decade and found that that company actually had gotten a list of people who had been convicted of felonies, and they then went on the voter registration database and they tried to match to see how many of those felons were on the list. And as you pointed out, they then identified wrongly thousands of people who they claimed were on the voter registration rolls and who were felons. And so the Secretary of State for Florida then and some local officials then purged them off the voting rolls without notice. And they then, when they showed up to vote, they were not on the list. And so they had been purged. And it was later discovered that, in fact, the people who had done the matching of the two lists had used improper criteria. Many people share the same name or even sometimes share the same name and same birthday. So you can't just make an assumption that if a name matches or things like that or a date of birth matches that it's necessarily the correct person. So many, many people got disenfranchised as a result of that. And that still happens today, actually, in a lot of places.
And I think it's so important to look at this history, because a lot of the people who were involved in that 2000 election are running for president today. They'll be on stage tonight. So Ari Berman writes that Ted Cruz, a 29-year-old domestic policy advisor on the Bush campaign at the time and a former law clerk for Chief Justice Rehnquist, put together George W. Bush's legal team, and one of his first calls was to John Roberts, whom Cruz knew from the close-knit network of former Rehnquist clerks. So Roberts flew down to Tallahassee and edited these legal briefs, including the Bush campaign's 50-page submission to the Supreme Court. They basically wanted to prevent Al Gore's team from Florida, really, from recounting the ballots. So, Jerry, talk about the significance of this history and why it's important to go back to 2000.
Well, it's important because it shows you how important our elections are and why people should make every effort to participate and exercise the fundamental right to vote. I mean, I was just thinking about this morning, Rose, when I was in the Department of Justice, and I looked around the room and I saw the Attorney General Lynch there and officials of the Department of Justice, and I realized that elections matter, and that the people who fill that room, and today we're celebrating the Voting Rights Act, it would have been far different if somebody else had been in the White House instead of Barack Obama and his appointees at the Department of Justice. Going back to 2000, I mean, that's really when I think election law and voting rights really started to be in the forefront of people's minds. And when you think about the right to vote, it's the most fundamental right we have as Americans. It's preservative of all of our other rights, and it shouldn't be infringed for any reason. I think most Americans in their gut level feel that everybody should be allowed to vote without hindrance. But sadly, you have people like now Senator Cruz and Chief Justice Roberts who really have never really done a lot to advance the cause of voting rights, but in fact have done their best in some instances to actually suppress voting rights.
Tomas, what are your thoughts about the pushback to what happened in 2000? Because after George W. Bush was inaugurated, John Ashcroft was Attorney General, and he fired a lot of civil rights lawyers from the DOJ's Civil Rights Division, which enforced the Voting Rights Act, and he replaced them with what Ari Berman calls ultra-conservative zealots, like Brad Scholzman, for example, who vowed to gerrymander all of those crazy libs right out of the section. And then from there, I mean, we just saw a wave of laws to disenfranchise voters. Other than organizations like yours, I mean, how did the Democrats respond to this?
I mean, I think one of the big challenges that we see when we deal with the right to vote is that we believe pretty strongly that it shouldn't have to be a partisan issue, that everybody deserves a voice, that every eligible citizen should get to cast a ballot. And one of the challenges we're dealing with right now when we talk about these voting restrictions is that in many ways it concerns politicians who are trying to manipulate the system. And what we really need is a system that is responsive to voters, that's accountable to voters, and when we think about the possibilities for reform, there are good things that are happening. And those good things that are happening are all things that actually empower individuals and that actually make voting more accessible for people.
We'll talk about those in a minute. But I wanted to talk, and I hate to focus on the negative here, but These voting restrictions are really important. I mean, people are literally being turned away at the polls because their names are either on a felon list and they're not felons, or their address is misspelled, and then they have to go to City Hall to get it taken care of. And these people are standing in line for up to five hours, maybe even longer. I mean, this is what's happening in the year 2014 in the United States. So Other than voter ID laws, that gets the most attention. Can you talk about some of the other voting restrictions that we're seeing?
Sure. I mean, one thing that I think I mentioned a little earlier, we've seen among the changes in North Carolina are reductions to early voting. We see that people are busy. They lead busy lives, and that voting isn't necessarily something that needs to be restricted to, a 10-hour period, a 12-hour period on a Tuesday in November. In North Carolina, you had the ability to vote for a few weeks before Election Day, including in many cases on Sunday. Sundays were particularly popular with voters in North Carolina, especially African-American voters. People could go from church to the polls, soul to the polls, they would call it. And this was something that was seriously cut back on in North Carolina. Another example, this would be in Ohio. In Ohio, there used to be an overlapping period where you could both register to vote and vote during the early voting period. People called it a golden week. And in 2014, that was eliminated. And so you see restrictions that not only affect people when they're actually at the polls, but affect people's ability to show up at the polls in the first place.
And also to add to your list, in North Carolina, in addition to cutting early voting days, they eliminated same-day registration and pre-registration for high school students, imposed the strict photo ID requirement. And then this one in Texas, you can use your concealed weapon permit as ID to vote, but you cannot use a student ID card. And again, this is the federal court. Jerry, you just mentioned the federal court just found this yesterday, that the Texas voter ID law violated the Voting Rights Act. Jerry, what other restrictions can you tell us about?
Well, going back to the issue about the felon lists, in Florida, which is always and has such a long history of discrimination against minority voters, the state of Florida, for example, even after the debacle involving felon lists, then went ahead and tried to do a match a few years ago of non-citizens who they felt were on the voter registration list. And they then tried to do a systematic purge of people who were allegedly non-citizens, only to find out that the list was flawed, that the that they were doing lots of mismatches. And as a result, people had to go to court. Again, civil rights and voting rights groups went to court, and they got it stopped, much to their credit. But again, here's an example of where preclearance would have been able to step in and block a law like that. There are other examples, though, of moving polling places today to make it more inconvenient for minority voters. In Galveston County, Texas, for example, right after the Shelby County case came down, Galveston County, Texas, which had tried to eliminate some minority districts where minority Latinos were being elected, they had tried to eliminate those offices, and the Justice Department had blocked it under the preclearance provisions. Shelby County came down, and Galveston immediately implemented and eliminated those districts. And so plaintiffs, we immediately went to federal court, and we have we've had a trial, and we're awaiting a decision. Jurisdictions that tried to move a date. In Augusta, Richmond County, Georgia, they used to elect their local officials in November. They tried to move it to August. Before Shelby, DOJ had objected to that because it was going to have a disproportionate effect on African-American voters there, so they blocked it. Immediately after Shelby came down, then Augusta and Richmond County moved it, and plaintiffs had tried to go to court to do something about it. So those are the kinds of shenanigans that, frankly, here we are 50 years after the Voting Rights Act. And when I first started to do this work, I mean, it was all about trying to prevent people from being denied the right to vote. We were very successful for those first decade. And now we then moved into a second generation where we went after voting schemes that were dilutive of minority voting strength, and we made a lot of progress there. Now we're back to vote denial cases. It's really astonishing when you consider America as the leading democracy in the world, and we're still fighting about whether people should have an unfettered right to vote.
What do you think this does to the psyche of these people? Sammy Louise Bates is a good example. She testified in the Texas trial last year over the voter ID laws, and she helped her grandma count out her poll tax, you know, back in the 50s. And this made her really angry, so she wanted to become a lifelong voter. In 2013, when she went to vote, she said that they told her that she needed a different ID, and it would cost her $42 to get her Mississippi birth certificate, and she said she couldn't afford it. So, Jerry, I just wonder, at both of you, really, what does this do to the psyche of these people? Because, first of all, this is incredibly humiliating. You've got to go spend money to get your certificate, stand in, you know, up to 5-hour lines then to try to vote again. And in some cases, you're told, sorry, polling place is closed. You've been here for 3 to 5 hours, but you've got to go home. I mean, you know, last election in 2014, we saw the lowest voter turnout in 72 years. And I wonder if this is connected. What are your thoughts on that, Jerry?
Well, I was there in the courtroom when Ms. Bates testified, and it was powerful testimony and emotional testimony because these are people, for the most part, who have been voting for many years without any problem whatsoever. We put on other witnesses, World War II veterans, Korean veterans who fought for this country and who don't have a photo ID. I mean, most people are under the misimpression that everybody has a photo ID. Well, of course, that's not true. 600,000 Texans who were registered to vote were shown not to have an ID, and Texas admitted as much. So it's very emotional for people at a gut level. In fact, the Campaign Legal Center did a film. It's a short 3-minute version of the film on our website where we actually interviewed some people who had been victims, who had been voting for years but now couldn't get the ID despite all these kind of bureaucratic hurdles. And what we found, Rose, was that in Texas, and this is, you know, not uncommon, that the Texas legislature calibrated exactly what IDs they knew could be used and which ones would be used or possessed more by minority voters. And every time that somebody offered an amendment to bring in one of the student IDs could be used, they said no, because that was disproportionately possessed by minorities. State government, you can't even vote in Texas by showing a state government employee ID. You can't, if you're an FBI agent in Texas and you show your FBI photo credentials, that doesn't allow you to vote. But a license to carry a firearm, where 91% of the people who own a firearm in Texas and have a permit are white or Anglo, that is a permissible thing. So they picked and choose IDs that are aimed at minority voters. And they say they do it sometimes for partisan reasons, but if you're a victim of that kind of conduct, it doesn't really matter why you're being disenfranchised. What matters is that you're being denied.
And we had a couple of years of voter fraud in the media on a regular basis. And Rob just wrote in and said, something just came across my Facebook feed saying 10 cases of voter fraud have been documented since 2000. Is this correct? And Loyola University Law School professor Justin Levitt looked at voter fraud from 2000 to 2014. In that time, more than 1 billion ballots were cast. And he found 31 cases of voter fraud, some of which involved multiple ballots. So 31 cases in 2000 to 2014. And yet, Tomas, a lot of the politicians that are implementing these restrictions say it's because of, quote, voter fraud.
Exactly. You know, when we look at these laws, when we look at these efforts to restrict the vote, that we see they're actually more about politicians who are trying to manipulate the system to their benefit. You know, I think everybody can agree that we want an election system that's reliable, but we also want an election system where every eligible citizen can participate. And one of the things, to go back to your earlier question, Rose, about how individuals are affected by this, I mean, one thing I would mention is that not only do we have these new restrictions, but we have broad old structural restrictions like our felony disenfranchisement laws. There are about 5 million Americans in the United States who cannot vote because of a criminal conviction at some point in their past. In a state like Florida, that's over 1 million people. In Kentucky, the population of people who are out of incarceration and cannot vote because of a prior felony conviction would be that state's third largest city. These are not things that can necessarily be addressed through the Voting Rights Act, but are issues that people should know about and that are happening in all these different states. Just the other day in California, there was really some very positive news in a settlement on a lawsuit that's going to give the right to vote now to thousands of people who previously were disenfranchised because of a conviction in their past.
It's tens of thousands, right?
That's right.
Yeah, that's a lot of people. So let's talk about, so that's good news in California. We did a show about the good news in Oregon. When you go to the DMV, you're automatically registered to vote. That's going to put so many new people on the rolls. But there are very few instances of positive news furthering voting rights in this country. What can people do about this? Because it's pretty concerning when you look at the next election next year. 15 states will have new voting restrictions in place for that presidential election. Tomas, what is going on behind the scenes to try to fight these restrictions?
Well, I think one thing that you're seeing is that we're fighting in the courts. Just yesterday, we had this great ruling from Texas, from the Fifth Circuit. There's the North Carolina trial that we are waiting on a decision about. And so I think it's important for people to understand that these aren't going unresponded to. And so number one, there's response happening in the courts. And number two, advocates and the public are continuing to push for positive changes. You just described the law that was passed in Oregon for automatic voter registration. Laws inspired by that we're seeing those being introduced in different parts of the country. We're seeing efforts to roll back our felony disenfranchisement laws. This year in Maryland, the legislature passed a bill that would give 40,000 people the right to vote who are currently on parole and probation. They're living in our communities. They are working. They are trying to build good lives. Unfortunately, the governor vetoed that, and next year they're going to have the opportunity to actually override that veto. And so just as often as we're seeing, you know, we continue to see these restrictions, but it doesn't mean that we're looking around and saying, oh, no, what are we going to do? We're trying to pass good laws, and we're fighting the bad laws in court.
And, Jerry, what would you add to that?
Well, Rose, I'm going to announce something here on your show, the first time I think it's been said publicly, but I'm launching a Voting Rights Institute starting next month, and it will have a website for people that can register a complaint or even ask a question about their voting rights, and we will have legal resources that we can match up with people if it turns out to be a legal issue or a problem. And in addition, as you probably know, there's around election time in particular, there's an election protection that all of the civil rights and voting rights groups have. 1-866-OUR-VOTE is where you can call and get information about that. But between that and the Voting Rights Institute, we hope to be able to connect voters with real-time information about their right to vote and how to resolve problems that they're having, or even if they just have a question, and we can help them find where they're supposed to vote and things like that.
And Jerry, what's the website? Where can we find more information?
Okay, we're getting ready to launch it, but it'll be votingrightsinstitute.org.
Great. And that sounds fantastic. We'd love to do a show about that once it gets off the ground. And a quick question. I'm sure a lot of us have friends in Texas, Ohio, North Carolina, and other states with strong restrictions. Is there a way to try to find out if your name is on a felon list or one of these lists that would prevent you from voting before Election Day?
Yes, is the answer. You can typically call your local registrar to say, that if you hear that there's a matching system going on where they're trying to purge felons, you can call your registrar and talk to the people in the registration office. The lists of who is a convicted felon, in some states it's public and in some states it's not. And again, that's another hopeful effort through the Voting Rights Institute that we can get information for people and be able to contact state officials and resolve problems like that before they happen.
Yes, and it's important to do that a year in advance, so do that now.
Exactly.
Well, thank you. You both do such great work, and I just want to thank you so much. Jerry Hebert and Tomas Lopez, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the treatment of undocumented immigrants in detention centers and an investigation about U.S. employers exploiting documented guest workers. We'll also talk about the tragic killing of the renowned Mexican photojournalist Ruben Espinosa. We'll be joined by BuzzFeed's Jessica Garrison, The Huffington Post's Roque Planas, and the Dallas Morning News' Alfredo Cochado. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.